drawing it out until she noticed the look on Mackenzie's face, not quite impatient but silently pleading with her to hurry, and felt guilty. She read what she could once more and added, "And there's a bee at the bottom." Maud almost jumped out of her chair at this.
"A bee? You didn't say that before."
"I'm saying it now. I didn't realize I hadn't said it out loud before. I'm sorry."
"That's a pretty important detail to just leave out."
Maud took the letter back again, searching for the bee. "Right there," Suna pointed. "I'm pretty sure it's a bee. B for Brett."
"May I?"
Mackenzie held out her hand, and Maud reluctantly gave her the letter.
"I don't think that's a bee. I think it's a heart. Tipped over on its side a little,"
Mackenzie said, excited.
"This looks like it was written by a woman. It's very pretty handwriting."
"Some men have pretty handwriting," said Maud, staring past Mackenzie at the clock on the wall behind her.
"I've known a man with gorgeous penmanship."
She plucked the letter from Mackenzie's hands and squinted at it.
"Like this. It looked just like this, I'm almost certain."
Then she seemed to reconsider her tone. She handed the letter back to Mackenzie.
"You have younger eyes than Susan. Could it be an R? An R could look like a B or a heart, couldn't it?"
Suna opened her mouth to correct Maud, but closed it again. Maud could call her whatever she wanted. It wasn't like they'd be talking much after today, but she'd have to talk to her more now just to say that her name wasn't Susan. Mackenzie shrugged.
"I'm sorry, Maud. I wish I could read more too, but what's not there just isn't."
Maud pressed her lips together and raised the forehead where her eyebrows presumably once were.
"Okay. Well, then."
Suna took the letter back again. "Actually, that's not entirely true. That what's not there isn't, I mean. There's enough here to assume a few of the words that aren't, right?"
"True," said Mackenzie, leaning in.
"Oh, like that cup there. That's paper cup. It's a coffee shop. It's by the airport, like it says. Just on the other side of the Louvain. It's cute. They have good pastries. That's what it was supposed to say."
Suna nodded. "Yeah, like that. Great. I don't know this town well enough to know stuff like that. Maud, you got a pen and paper?"
Maud made a stern face and shook her head.
"Whatever, I was just going to..." "Never mind. Whatever. Someone wants to meet someone at Paper Cup in the afternoon on an unknown day, and their name starts with a B," said Suna.
"Or it's a heart," said Mackenzie.
"Or it's an R," said Maud.
"That," Suna folded the letter and set it in the middle of the table, "is all. I literally," she looked straight at Maud, "can't read another word."
"You've forgotten the most important part," said Mackenzie.
"Which is?"
"The person they want to meet up with is either me or Maud."
"Or me," said Suna.
Maud frowned.
"Since when?"
"It just could be," said Suna. "Why not me?"
"Because you said yourself it wasn't?"
"No, I didn't. I just never said it was. I said I was waiting to see."
"You said you don't know people who mail letters."
"Yes, and then I actually read it. It says this person swung by, so it was a hand-delivered note. That's different."
Suna was swinging wildly from one hope that the letter was from Brett to another that it wasn't, with no pause in the middle.
Brett traveled a lot. It wasn't a stretch to think she'd gotten Suna's address from a mutual friend and stopped by. "Sorry I missed you." Would Brett be sorry to miss her?
That was the part that was more likely to be a stretch.
"Anyway," she said, standing. "Guess we'll never know. Too bad."
Was it too bad? "I guess we're done here then," said Maud,
though for all her subtlety, she might as well have shooed them out of her house with a broom. Her cat jumped up onto her lap and she gathered it into her arms and stood. The two stared at their unwelcome visitors, a unified front. Mackenzie leaned over the table like she was ready to grab hold of it and hang on if someone tried to make her leave.
"Okay," she said. "The things we don't know are the day, the exact time, and who is meeting who. So let's figure it out. We'll go together."
"What?" Suna was confused. "Go where?"
"To Paper Cup, starting tomorrow. From 12 until close, to cover all our bases. every day until someone's person shows.
Maud sat back down, and the chair squeaked beneath her. She rested her hands on the cat's back, but the cat didn't relax under them.
Someone's person? What do you mean? We're all thinking of at least one person, aren't we?
Mackenzie looked from Maud to Suna and back again. No one said they were not.
I can tell. Someone important, I think, right?
Maud conceded with a nod.
Why 12 until close?
She looked at Mackenzie suspiciously, as though she'd found something in the letter that she was keeping from them. Mackenzie shrugged, still smiling at Maud, and if she felt irritated, she didn't show it, even for a second.
It's set afternoon, which works out well for me. I have classes in the morning and work at night, but I spend my afternoons writing and studying anyway. Might as well be at Paper Cup.
Oh, said Maud.
All right, then. And that will work for me as well. I'm retired.
Suna backed away from the table. She could go, too, if she wanted. She worked the coveted morning shift at Fire Fitness and was always out of there before noon. One of the perks of seniority was getting first crack at the work schedule. She traded sleeping in for free afternoons, and for her it was a worthwhile swap. She wasn't about to give up those afternoons for any number of consecutive coffee dates with Vulture Maud.
No thanks. Why not?
Because it's a massive waste of time.
No way, it'll be fun.
Mackenzie seemed to think this was a big adventure.
Besides, what if Maud and I go, but the letter's for you, and then we don't know when it's safe to stop going?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I just can't. Don't want to. The kitchen, which had initially smelled so strongly of bleach and lemons, now also smelled like thinly masked cigarette smoke and vinegar. The combination of nicotine and cleaning supplies began to make her nauseated.
Well, I'm going to go anyway, said
Mackenzie, her eyes big and serious.
I can think of people who might have written this letter to me, and I don't want to miss them if they show up.
Suna tried to quell her irritation. So call them or email them? It's not 1997. Ask them if they left you a letter in your mailbox and tell them it's not 1997 while you're at it. At this, Mackenzie's eyes glazed, but she kept smiling.
What if I could?
Suna knew she'd said something wrong, but didn't know how to fix it. She was being a hypocrite anyway. She sure wasn't going to call Brett and ask if she'd sent this letter. She looked down at her hands and then over at Maud, who was nodding so furiously that Suna pictured her head rolling off her shoulders and under the table.
I'm going to come too. You're a smart girl. I'm certainly not going to be the one to call.
Maud stopped herself and cleared her throat.
I'm coming too.
Suna considered this. Say Brett was in town for work. What then? Why wouldn't she just call like a normal person? Or better yet, stay gone. And who cared anyway? This was part of growing up. She'd known it for a long time. Sometimes you get closure, but most of the time you didn't. People who sat around pining for it were desperate. Her old friends in Toronto were like that, always wanting to discuss their feelings about incidents that had happened years before, always wanting to rehash breakups, to get together with friends who weren't friends anymore to see if anything could be salvaged.
Yeah, well, she said, you guys do that. I have a life.
This wasn't true, but she looked at Maud when she said it and smiled. Ex-punk. Larry.
The phone call woke Larry from a mid-afternoon nap. He'd fallen asleep in front of his TV watching a homemade documentary about a local punk band from the 90s. The video was objectively awful. The picture was grainy, the camera work jerky, and headache-inducing. It had been shot by a couple of the band's members' girlfriends, years before quality recording equipment was available to people who didn't make movies for a living. But the DIY nature of it reminded Larry of the good old days, listening to lo-fi recordings with a sense of non-ironic superiority, of going to shows in buddies' basements, where he thrashed and moshed and gave himself piercings and stick-and-poke tattoos without flinching. It reminded Larry of being young and feeling not cool, but like he was something even better. He was better than the cool kids. He was an angry, straight-edge punk, a misunderstood misfit. And he belonged to a small, tight-knit group of other misunderstood misfits. They crashed together in time with their discordant four-chord punk songs, took shoes to their faces, and generally danced like they were trying to beat the snot out of each other. They felt everything. It had been glorious. And now, it was so long ago that the fuel for the movement and for his involvement in it, angst, depression, rejection, had become romanticized and idealized. And he kind of thought he missed it. He missed the sharp, all-consuming feelings and their urgent and immediate call to action. He missed pain that proved something. Not like this dull back pain that came from being on his feet so much at the art gallery, forcing him to wear orthopedic shoes at 43. Nowadays, negative feelings just pooled in his gut and made him lethargic. Nowadays, all he had were these VHS tapes and old band t-shirts. "Hello?" he mumbled into the phone.
"Hello, Larry?"
Larry sat straight up. "Yes?" he said, his voice cracking, though it only had to deliver that one syllable. He tried another one with only slightly better luck. "Hey." It was Suna. He knew right away. He hadn't thought she'd call so soon. He hadn't thought she'd call at all. This was the best thing that had happened to him in a long time. She paused, and he considered all the different directions this conversation could take. It was a delight at first, and then excruciating. He stared at the wall, which was plastered with signed gig posters, like somewhere in the hand-lettered band names he could find clues about what Suna would say next. Time slowed. He couldn't wait to hear what words would come out of her mouth.
Hey, this is Suna. This is really embarrassing.
He was dreaming. He had to be dreaming.
I locked myself out of my place. Can you come by and...
So, okay, it was not quite flirtatious, but it was her saying something directly to him, and that was great, almost miraculous. She stopped speaking before she even finished asking the question, and this perplexed him until he realized that it was because he'd shouted, "Yes!" as she was still talking. It rang in his ears now, and he worried his enthusiasm might be off-putting. She paused again.
"Kay," she said. "Thank you, I'll just be in Mackenzie's apartment, the basement suite, when you get here."
She hung up without saying goodbye. Or maybe she had said goodbye. Maybe he was too far up in the clouds to notice. Picaroon Pizza and the Dread Pirate Hairs. Mackenzie. Picaroon Pizza was, as the name implied, a pirate-themed pizza parlor owned by Randall Hares, a middle-aged Scottish man who had only ever wanted to be a pirate when he grew up. Very few people only ever wanted to be one thing, and fewer actually became that thing in the end, but Randall Hares was living the dream. He was a pirate. Or at least he got to dress and talk like one every day. It was as close to his dream as he needed it to be. The quality of the food served at Picaroon was such that one could tell he was in it for the flair, for the ability to wear an eye patch to work every day, not his love of culinary arts. He drank like a pirate, too, starting first thing in the morning and carrying on until closing time. And to him, that was just another perk of owning Picaroon Pizza. He sauntered through his restaurant like Johnny Depp, singing yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. The customers couldn't tell whether it was an act or not. Maybe Randall didn't even know anymore. It was one of those things that was funny to witness until you witnessed it more than once, and then if you really thought about it, it was downright depressing. The restaurant was on the second floor of 1305 Hamilton Street and shared the space with Cafe Flash, which was not actually a cafe at all, but a kitschy gift shop. The first floor housed Reggie's Shoes, and it was hard to tell whether the overall smell of the building was of feet or pizza or the perfume worn by the owner of Cafe Flash. It all mingled together into a salty, flowery, pizza-saucy potpourri. Mackenzie had started to work at Picaroon 2 days after moving to Regina. Her parents hadn't wanted her to go to the city. They seemed to be rooting for her to struggle financially so she'd have to move back home. It felt like fate, then, that Grant was the first person she met at the university. He was smart, friendly, and helpful. He helped her find her first class, and when she mentioned she was looking for a job, he told her that Picaroon Pizza, where he had been employed for 3 months already, was hiring. She would soon realize that Picaroon Pizza was always, always hiring, urgently hiring, and at first she would wonder why. The job interview was theatrical and hysterical and exciting. It was more like going to a play than interviewing for a food service position. Her uniform came complete with a stuffed shoulder parrot and papier-mâché sword. Mackenzie thought, at first, that Randall was hilarious, and she smiled enthusiastically at customers and said, "Polly, want a drink with that?" Just like she'd been instructed to in her offbeat training session. But after only a month of watching Randall Hares sway and flail around the kitchen like he was on the deck of a ship instead of in a busy workplace, Mackenzie began neglecting her R's when she thought Randall might not notice. He did not care about health code violations, but he absolutely hated it when his employees broke character. The day the letter arrived, Mackenzie considered calling in sick. All the little absurdities of Picaroon Pizza, the decor, the uniforms, the lingo, were irritating on a normal day. On that day, she wondered if she could stand them at all. She went back to her basement suite after they read the letter. She locked the deadbolt on the door at the top of the stairs, like always, giving the handle an extra tug to make sure it was secure, and tucked a chair under the handle of the door at the bottom of the stairs. She walked around the perimeter of her space, checking the windows, the closets, the corners, under the bed, under the table, behind the couch. Satisfied that she was safe, she made some coffee and sat at her table. Maud had insisted on keeping the letter, which had enraged Suna. Mackenzie couldn't decide if Suna was an angry person in general or just an angry person at Maud. Mackenzie hadn't cared at the time who kept the letter, but now, back in the quiet of her own space, she wished she had it. She'd thought she wouldn't forget the few incomplete lines, but they had already become foggy and pixelated, like the fragments of a dream. She wanted to read it again, to examine it for any kind of familiarity that might tell her who wrote it. She felt sure it was meant for her, but was increasingly unsure about who the author was. She saw two faces in her mind's eye, two people who could have written a letter like that. But when she tried to picture either person saying the words, she just heard Suna, her voice hard and thin and irritated. "Sorry for disappearing," Mackenzie whispered. "No, sorry I missed you." She tried to hear her sister's voice, and then Jared's. Now she could only hear herself. If she had the letter, she could see if there was a comma in that sentence. Was it, "Sorry and I missed you," or was the sender just sorry they had missed running into her? She wandered into the living room, clutching her mug with both hands. The floor snapped above her head, likely Suna or just the sound of wood shifting as the weather grew colder, and she jumped, spilling hot coffee over the sides of the mug and onto her hands. This, the thing that should have made her flinch, barely registered. It was like her nerve endings were turned off, like her body was spending all its energy being afraid. She set the cup on the coffee table and wiped her hands on her shirt. She wondered if she would ever stop being afraid. Rain began to hit the windows, and she heard a soft but powerful crack of thunder, like a car crash very far away. The lights flickered, and the ceiling above her creaked again. This made her decision easier. If the power went out, she'd rather be at work. Being annoyed was better than being scared, and she was scared enough with the lights on. She changed it into her uniform and made herself a sandwich, suddenly anxious to leave the fidgety old house. As she finished the last bites of her meal, she heard a shuffling sound on the landing upstairs and paused mid-bite. There was a knock, and she swallowed, the bread suddenly dry, like a chunk of wood scraping down her throat. "Hello?" she rasped. "It's me, Suna." "Come in," she called, slightly louder, relieved and embarrassed. Who else would it have been? Why did her body still react to everything like it was an emergency situation? She stood and brushed the breadcrumbs off her ruffled picaroon shirt, grimacing at the thought of Suna coming in and finding her dressed like this. "Can't, it's locked." "Right," Mackenzie moved the chair, opened the door, ran up to the locked one at the top of the stairs, slid the deadbolt out of its track, fiddled with the lock on the handle. A humiliating process when someone else was waiting and witnessing it, like she was making performance art of her paranoia. When she opened that door, Suna surveyed her with a mix of judgment and amusement. "What are you doing down there, moving furniture around?" Mackenzie blushed. "No." "And you're dressed like a pirate?"
"Yep."
She shifted, and her oversized black boots squeaked. Randall was too cheap to order new costumes for new employees, so she had inherited one from a guy a couple of sizes bigger.
"You weren't dressed like a pirate before."
"Sure wasn't."
Suna's forehead creased.
So I got locked out of my apartment when I went to check the mail. The landlord is coming, but I was wondering if I could stay in here for a few minutes. He's taking forever, and this entryway isn't heated, and it's kind of cold out there. This city is cold. It's colder here this time of year than it ever was in Toronto.
Suna said this accusingly, like Mackenzie was in charge of the weather.
"You've just been standing out here all this time?"
Mackenzie asked, forgetting her embarrassment over the chair and the door and the pirate costume.
"I'm so sorry, I didn't realize. You could have come in here sooner."
"I wish I had. Looks like I missed the pirate party."
Mackenzie was terrible at being cold to people. She gave up.
"It's for work," she said.
"You work on a ship?"
"Picaroon Pizza."
"Oh yeah, I've seen the sign for that place on Hamilton, right?"
"Yep."
I work around the corner, actually, at Fire Fitness. I'm a trainer."
Mackenzie stepped back and motioned for Suna to follow her.
"Sorry, come in. Sit down. Coffee?"
"Great, thanks."
At the bottom of the stairs, Suna studied Mackenzie's kitchen.
"It's nice down here. Bright for a basement."
"I'm enjoying it. Lots better than living in my parents' house. Here."
Mackenzie set a half-full mug in front of Suna.
"Sorry, that's all that was left in the pot. I can't even make more. I need to go out and buy beans."
"No, this is great. Thanks."
A car drove by, its wheels sloshing through a puddle. The furnace clunked and settled into a hum. Maud may have been antagonistic, but at least she kept awkward silences at bay. Suna sipped at her coffee, staring absently at the two intricate poppies inked just above the crook of Mackenzie's arm.
"I like your tattoo."
"Thanks."
Mackenzie worried Suna was going to ask her to explain the meaning behind the flowers. She touched them instinctively.
"I'm curious," Suna said. "Who is it?"
"Who?"
Mackenzie asked cautiously.
"You said before that you knew who might have written that letter. Seemed kinda urgent about it, I guess."
"Oh, I don't know. It could be lots of people."
Mackenzie placed her hand over the flowers protectively. Suna had asked the question Mackenzie expected, just in a different way.
"An ex?"
Suna pressed, oblivious to Mackenzie's discomfort.
"Maybe."
She pictured Jared writing the letter, driving up to the house in his old blue pickup truck with his grandmother's necklace hanging from the rearview mirror, walking up to the house and slipping the envelope into the mailbox, thinking of her but too afraid to face her just yet.
"Sorry, I missed you."
Or maybe he'd come to the house to face her, but she'd been at the university and he'd sat on the front porch and written the note.
"Sorry, I missed you."
Or friends or other people. She laughed, like she hadn't given too much thought to the whole thing. I feel like everyone has a list of people who could send them a letter like that, right? People they wish would come and explain things to them, apologize to them. Probably another list of people we need to explain and apologize to. She smiled weakly and pretended to take a drink from her empty coffee cup. Suna raised her eyebrows a little, but everything else on her face stayed perfectly still. Mackenzie wondered if she did Botox. Did Botox? Used Botox? Had Botox done? At 19, Mackenzie was too young to know the terminology of the unhappily aging.
"But is there someone in particular you hope it is? I mean, you said so earlier."
Mackenzie grimaced.
"You know what, Suna, I'm actually going to be late for work. Could you just lock the handle on your way out when Larry comes?"
Mackenzie stood, towering over Suna. In her ruffled shirt, a tricorn on her head,
She didn't feel like having a heart-to-heart. She hunched forward, trying to make herself a little smaller.
But hey, I would be more than willing to continue this discussion if you find yourself at Paper Cup tomorrow.
I'll be more prepared, at least. Suna snorted.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I care enough.
About who wrote the letter? You don't care?
Nope, I don't care. Just straight up don't care.
Suna shifted in her seat and began to rub at something on the hem of her shirt. There was a loud thud above them, and both women glanced at the ceiling. Suna rolled her eyes and mumbled something under her breath about Maud.
Well, if you decide to come for the company, you know, I'll be there anyway. Just come for coffee.
Oh, said Suna. She looked surprised and then guilty, like she was just now realizing she'd been rude.
I guess it could be nice to go for coffee with someone. I don't really know anyone here yet, and I can't even remember the last time I went for coffee with someone. And I mean, most of my friends back home had babies. It was all they talked about. Parenting, diapers, babysitters.
Well, I don't have a baby, Mackenzie said, grabbing her Velcro parrot off the counter and stuffing it into her purse. Just this dumb parrot and this dumb shirt and these dumb boots. And I don't want to talk about any of it.
Okay.
Suna shifted in her seat. I mean, Maud will be there, though, so probably won't.
Fair enough. But if you end up coming, I'll be there, too. You can sit with me. And I promise I won't be dressed like this.
Good, said Suna. She looked embarrassed again. And Mackenzie felt sorry for her. It was like she couldn't help herself.
I mean, but if you did, that would be totally fine, too. You don't look bad. I mean,
she took a long drink of coffee and chuckled.
For a pirate.
Mackenzie smiled.
Well, thank you.
When Mackenzie opened the door upstairs, Larry was there, his hand in midair as though he'd been about to knock. He looked excited and then disappointed when he saw her. She smiled at him anyway, putting the pieces together easily enough. That look of excitement was not usually for her. Suna probably saw it a lot. Hi, Larry.
Hey,
he said, trying to peer around her without being obvious.
How's it going?
Mackenzie asked, when he didn't move to let her pass. She wasn't good at asking people to move, and he didn't appear to excel at picking up on social cues, so they could be stuck there for a while.
Great, said Larry. Yep, good.
His head bobbed forward on his giraffe-like neck.
Good,
said Mackenzie. Larry cleared his throat.
You going out? Costume party?
No, to work.
Ah, yeah, of course.
He seemed embarrassed to have suggested she might be wearing a costume, and Mackenzie was too tired to explain. He considered her big black boots. He shifted, and she thought he was moving out of her way, so she took a step forward, but he hadn't been, so now she was just closer to him.
The Planks used to dress like pirates,
he said, almost to himself. Mackenzie tried not to look confused. She nodded, hoping he would think she knew what he was talking about and let her go. No such luck. He chuckled, as though she'd asked him to explain himself.
Local band. Called themselves the Planks. They all wore pirate boots just like those.
He stopped short, like he realized he'd put his foot in his mouth.
Not that your boots are pirate boots,
he began. No, they are, she said. He nodded.
Cool,
he said, nodding, nodding, nodding.
Yeah, the Planks. I used to go to all their shows. If they were playing, I was there.
Mackenzie was going to be late for work. She looked longingly over his shoulder.
Yeah, what kind of music?
Punk, he said.
He was still looking over her shoulder, too. He looked supremely sad.
We had a good scene back then. There weren't a lot of us, and
he cleared his throat again.
No one big ever came here, but the local guys were great. Played in basements and garages mostly, and at the underground. It was the best. Used to be a German restaurant called the Schnitzel House, and it was owned by people who didn't even like punk music. They just liked people, so they let the punks play there.
He was talking fast, and he had a distant look on his face like he was telling her about another country, a place he'd lived once but could never go back to. He ran a hand through his hair, looking lost. And she felt sorry for him. A silence followed.
and it was even more awkward than the longing-filled conversation. She grasped for something to say. "Do you go to shows at the Exchange often?" Grant had asked her this very question earlier in the week, and she changed the subject fast so she didn't have to admit that she didn't go anywhere after dark except work, that the only shows she'd ever seen were ones uploaded onto YouTube.
"Oh."
His eyes lit up.
"Well, no, I haven't been to a show in years. I mean, but maybe I should."
He seemed to be asking her for permission. Far be it from her to tell him he couldn't go to a show if he wanted to.
"Yeah, you should, Larry. It's on the website, ticket prices and concert listings and stuff."
"So..." They both let out a big breath in unison. She smiled. "Anyway, are you here to let Suna in?"
"Oh, yeah,"
he said, suddenly nervous again.
Is she..."
"Yep," said Mackenzie. "She's down in my apartment. You can just unlock her door and I'll let her know it's open." Larry's face fell.
"Oh," he said. "Don't let me keep you. I can go down and..."
He trailed off, clearly realizing that he was offering to go into Mackenzie's apartment without her, and that was kind of a strange thing to do.
"No,"
he said, almost to himself.
"You're right, that is better. If you go, I'll just unlock it for her and be off."
He gestured at his truck. He might as well have shown up in a tux with flowers and some kind of romantic declaration written in the sky behind him in the smoke of a small airplane. They were finally able to synchronize their movements. They each took a step to their right. He unlocked Suna's door, and Mackenzie decided to wait a moment before calling down for Suna to come up. It felt like a small favor Suna would never know about. Larry seemed harmless enough, but still. Mackenzie watched Larry walk down the sidewalk, a heavy wallet chain slapping against his leg with each step, and something occurred to her. Her heart sank. "Oh, hey, Larry, one thing." He turned. "There was a letter in the mailbox this afternoon. It was pretty mangled and we don't know who it's from, but I just now realized it's probably for you. Maud has it." Larry shook his head.
"Wouldn't be for me, I don't..."
He looked down, embarrassed.
"Have a lot of friends. And the ones I do have would never try to contact me here, let alone by mail. I've never lived here. Maybe it was for my aunt? But she's dead, so you can just chuck it. Unless it seemed important."
Mackenzie shook her head. "No, just someone writing to say they missed someone else." She felt deflated. The more possible recipients the letter had, the less likely it was that it was meant for her. And that was already pretty unlikely. It made sense that the letter would be for Larry's dead aunt. Way more sense than it being for one of the current inhabitants of the house. But when you're really hoping for something, and when that hope takes up so much space inside your ribcage that it's hard to eat or breathe in, you have to dismiss the things that make sense to make room for it. It's a survival thing. Larry, the very good landlord. Larry. Going to a punk show was not the same as going to the bank or going to the grocery store or going anywhere else in the entire world, actually. Going to a punk show meant you were going to be seen and subsequently labeled either as a punk or a poser, and your self-worth hinged on that label. But you had to act like you didn't care at all. Not even a little. You had to dress like you didn't care, but you had to get it right. Larry had all his clothes laid out on the bed like he was a teenager getting ready for the first day of high school. He was worrying that people would be able to tell just by looking at him how much work he'd put into this. But he had to put enough work into it that it looked effortless. He turned the CD player up and let Jello Biafra's quavering baritone voice fill the room until he could hardly hear himself think, "This is what this music was invented for." Music was the only override button for Larry's brain. It was like a bubble in the ocean, a place for him with none of the stuff inside of it that filled everything outside of it. It was just notes and chords and percussion. When he listened to punk music, his mind, which never stopped running, stopped running. That was why he couldn't have lived in that house. His mind would have run him to death in that silence. What was the cutoff date in the will? 1952? The earliest punk band Larry knew of was Los Psychos, and they didn't come along until the 60s. At Mackenzie's suggestion, he'd gone onto the Exchange website and saw that there was a show tonight. Tonight. The headliner was a local band called Jetleg. There was no picture of them on the site, and when he tried Googling them on his phone, Google asked him if he would like to search instead for jet lag, and then showed him 76,800,000 search results for jet lag anyway. Still, jet lag sounded punkish. The gig poster on the website was messy and cheap, like someone had given a ninth grader a Sharpie marker in 2 minutes, which was promising. That was what gig posters were supposed to look like. He couldn't wait to once again be shoulder to shoulder with other people in a room too loud for conversation. But a bad thought burst his bubble. What if this show was the new punk? He'd gone into CD Plus way back in the day, what, 2006? And asked the kid working behind the counter to show him some new punk. And the kid had given him a whole stack of terrible, terrible CDs and said they were great. Whiny children playing fast and calling it punk. They weren't fooling anyone. What if that was what he was walking into tonight? Or worse, what if all his old buddies were there and they thought he was a poser now? None of his clothes fit, right? He didn't know what was going on. What was worse, being the only punk in a room or being the only poser? He was drowning in the ocean now, and not even Jello Biafra could save him. He didn't hear his phone ring, but he looked down just as it lit up with a call from an unknown number, and he scrambled to mute the music. Hello? Hello, Larry. Larry sat straight up and looked around, even though the voice came from his cell phone. His blood cells were like pop rocks.
Aunt Rebecca?
He gulped.
Is that you?
Aunt Rebecca had been dead now for 6 months, or seven, or what day was it? What month? He'd never heard of the dead communicating this way, but then all the good ghost stories were from a time before smartphones. Were smartphones that smart? He pinched the skin on the back of his hand to see if he was dreaming.
No, Maud here, said the voice.
Right. Maud, he laughed out loud.
What's funny? Maud sounded like she didn't appreciate funny things.
Nothing, said Larry.
Maud cleared her throat. We need you to come fix the mailbox, Larry, as soon as possible, please.
Oh, right.
Does tonight work for you?
She didn't wait for him to reply.
You need to take care of it before it rains again. We're having such trouble with water getting into it, and dogs or mice or something, too, and ruining the coupons. I've spent a substantial amount of money on full-price items that I should have gotten for at least 10% off. Also, I'm going to need you to come look at, I don't know, the radiator or something in my suite. It's making a racket. And is there something you can do to make the other tenants' doors less squeaky? They're always going in and out of this place in the middle of the night, and it wakes me up.
She started hacking into her phone, and he held his away from his ear.
Also, Larry.
She started speaking again before she'd fully recovered.
There's a... excuse me. Strange sound coming from the attic. A scraping kind of noise. You should look into that, too, while you're here.
She finally seemed to be done. He looked at the calendar hanging on the wall. It was still on August of the previous year. Who was he kidding, keeping a calendar, as though he needed help keeping track of a schedule? He had no schedule. He had exactly one activity besides his night shifts at the art gallery planned for this whole month. Luckily, it fell on one of his nights off. Tonight.
Yeah, he said. I can't come tonight. I'm going to a show. A punk show.
That felt great to say. Like he'd been in a coma for years and years, and tonight, for the first time in a long time, he was going to open his eyes and walk around. But it was also becoming more terrifying by the minute. The clock on the wall ticked loudly, and it seemed to be chanting at him, like an angsty mosh pit full of zit-faced 16-year-olds.
Poser, poser, poser.
Was there anything more pathetic than a grown man who worried about teenagers thinking mean thoughts at him? Maud interrupted his frantic thoughts. She didn't know what a punk show was and asked him to explain.
It's a genre of music, he said, his mind still racing. Like rock, but faster, more political. It encompasses a lot of subgenres. You've got your tamer stuff, your punk rock, your cow punk, your...
Larry, can you go to that another night? This is important.
Okay,
he said, surprising himself. But what else could he say? He wasn't chickening out on the punk show. The old lady needed him. He was being kind. He wasn't washed up or lame or intimidated. He was kind. He was being a good landlord.
Thank you, said Maud, without sounding overly thankful. And?
Larry waited.
And?
No, that's it, said Maud. Thank you.
Click.
So, that night, instead of going to a punk show, Larry went to the Montreal house and replaced the one existing mailbox. He installed two more, one for 2139B and one for 2139C. He bought stickers to mark them and used a ruler to make sure he applied them straight. No one answered when he knocked, so he let himself into the small entrance. The smell of Aunt Rebecca still clung to the walls of the old house, enveloping him as he stepped inside, just like she used to. He'd always loved Aunt Rebecca, but he'd never loved the way she smelled. He gagged a little. Moving quickly, he opened each door and applied WD-40 to all the hinges, even though they didn't strike him as being all that loud. What was the other thing? A noisy radiator? Noises in the attic? He glanced up the stairs to Maud's part of the house, toward the attic, and shuddered. He would tell Maud if she called back that radiators were noisy and so were old houses and he couldn't do anything about it. Old houses were full of screeching door hinges and banging radiators. She'd get used to it. He locked all the doors back up and left, stopping when he reached the sidewalk to admire the old house. If nothing else, if not a punk, if not a member of anything elite or particularly cool, he was a good landlord. He smiled and enjoyed a rare moment of satisfaction. He began the short walk to his car. Across the street, an old man in a black sport coat made his way down the sidewalk with small, lurching steps, out for a leisurely stroll around the neighborhood. Larry smiled and nodded courteously at the man, who disregarded him entirely. As Larry turned back for one last look at the house, hoping, perhaps, that he would see Suna coming out of it, his eyes were drawn up toward the attic window, almost involuntarily, as though they'd been caught by a sudden movement. But it was too dark, and he couldn't have seen anything, really. Not even if there had been something to see. Which, Larry knew, there was.
Brenda's very exciting morning. Suna. Regina was a funny place. People referred to it as a city, and it technically was, but it was a city in the same way an 18-year-old was an adult. Just barely, and unconvincingly so. The skyline resembled the mouth of a 6-year-old in the middle of losing baby teeth. Just a few scattered, stubby towers. Traffic was sparse, and the downtown area was quiet. It was nice, though. Suna was pleasantly surprised by both the size and location of the suite she could afford. There was a library only a few blocks away. Her bedroom was bigger than her whole apartment in Toronto, and the walk to work took 10 minutes. The short journey took her through a quiet neighborhood full of mature trees and colorful homes, and then onto Broad, a busy street lined with offices and hair salons and coffee shops. On October 1st, the day of the bomb threats, Suna didn't have anyone scheduled until 8 a.m., so she was taking her time, enjoying the few other people she saw. She craved social interaction, even if it was just a thank you wave to someone in a car who stopped to let her cross the street. She first registered the sirens as she passed the blood bank, a choir of alarms coming from the direction in which she was headed, growing steadily louder.
She waited for a line of emergency vehicles to pass by, but they stayed where they were. She walked faster. A few blocks from her gym, she was met with tape and police cars. She couldn't get closer. She followed the barriers for a few blocks before realizing the entire downtown area was taped off. Hordes of people lined the perimeter, talking loudly and trying to see. There was no smoke, but flashing lights reflected off every glassy surface. What could possibly have happened? Retreating from the chaos, Suna turned onto a quieter street and pulled out her phone. She tried calling the gym, but there was no answer, so she scrolled through her address book, looking for someone who didn't belong to her past life in Toronto. Lee, Irwin, Lawrence, Abe, Nicole. Nope, 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 nope. Wow. There was nothing more life-affirming than scrolling through an address book full of people who'd forgotten you the second you left their city. There was only one relevant name now, and it wasn't a name that sparked joy. Brenda. Brenda was the receptionist at Fire Fitness. She was a jarring, desperate person, with sleek blonde hair and a fluffy clump of 1992 bangs. She looked like a Yorkie poo. She cared very little about other people except if they liked her or not, though it almost felt at times like she was actively working to make sure they didn't. She talked over people and laughed too loud, expelling warm blasts of mint gum and halitosis so pungent it almost tricked you into thinking you could see it, like smog. Suna had not anticipated actually ever calling Brenda, but here she was.
Hello?
Suna could tell by the noise in the background that Brenda was in the middle of a crowd.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Suna, is that you?
What's going on, Brenda?
Just a moment, Suna. I have to walk over here a bit. It's noisy.
The crowd sounds lessened, but Brenda still shouted into the receiver, her voice distorted like music from a blown speaker.
Suna, good heavens! What's that?
I asked what's going on. Where are you?
Oh, dear, so much. So much is going on. The SWAT team is here, and the bomb squad, and firemen. Where are you, dear?
I don't know. Suna looked around for street signs. The corner of 13th and Rose? Why is the SWAT team there? What's going on, Brenda?
Bomb threat!
Brenda yelled, her voice crackling and fuzzing out. She shouted something else that sounded like,
Can you believe it?
Can't understand you when you shout, Brenda.
Sorry!
Brenda shouted again, slower and louder.
Bomb threat! There was a bomb threat! Can you hear me now? I said,
Yeah, I hear you, Brenda. But when you shout, it's actually harder.
I've lived here for 30 years,
Brenda carried on,
and this is a first for me.
What building? Is anyone still inside?
Well, I don't know,
said Brenda, as though the thought hadn't occurred to her.
I sure hope not. Yikes, bikes!
Brenda liked pseudo-swears and half-baked expressions that made no sense, and used them when there were plenty of existing words and phrases that would have done just fine. Or no words at all, Suna thought. She wished she hadn't been curious enough about the fire trucks to call this woman. It wasn't worth it. Brenda had quieted and sounded frightened now, like the thought of a bomb was so abstract and movie-like that it hadn't caused her any real alarm before this conversation.
Oh, dear!
She shouted.
Oh, dear! I'm coming to find you right now, Suna!
Suna groaned.
No, Brenda, you stay where you are. I'll come find you.
Then she hung up before Brenda could call her bluff and fled 13th and Rose.
What's going on over there?
The question came from a delicate old man with cloudy eyes. He'd been leaning casually against the brick walls of an old apartment building, and she hadn't noticed him until he spoke.
I have no clue. I mean...
She waved a hand in the air to indicate she'd misspoken.
I mean, I've heard there was a bomb threat, but I don't know anything beyond that.
The man smiled.
Which building?
I don't know.
The art gallery, I bet.
He yawned and stretched like bomb threats were boring.
That's in the dead center of downtown, and it's run by a bunch of...
He checked himself.
Makes sense why they'd have to evacuate all the buildings. Biggest thing to happen in this city in a long time, I must say. We don't have a lot of action around here.
He paused to catch his breath.
But you're not from around here, eh?
Suna found herself shrinking from the man. He'd seemed innocuous at first. Now it felt like he might be enjoying her discomfort.
Yeah, actually I am, she lied.
But he knew. She could tell by the look on his face.
Suna!
Brenda. Almost on top of her, Brenda came to a halt, patting her hair, adjusting her jacket, hiking up her leggings.
I went to 13th and Rose, but you weren't there. This is 14th,
she brayed, gesturing at the sign above her.
Of course, I may have misheard you, but I don't think I did.
She giggled like they were sharing a joke.
Isn't this crazy? They're trying to get everyone to go home, but people want to know what's going on. It's like a big party.
It's not like a party at all, snapped Suna. What was with these small-town people and their giddiness over crime? People should go home. They could get hurt. Let the police do their job.
Well, you're here. We all have as much right to be here as you.
Brenda was indignant. I just got here and I'm leaving. You should leave too. Suna glanced back to where the old man had been standing, but he was gone, as though he'd melted into the wall behind him or vanished into thin air. The coffee shop beside the crematorium. Suna walked home slowly, past the hair salons and the blood bank. Her neighborhood was oblivious to the drama downtown, and the silence was downright eerie. She stopped just inside her front door. It felt wrong in her suite, and she couldn't figure out why. Had she left the curtains in the living room open like that? She didn't think so. When those curtains were open, she could see into the neighbor's house, and presumably they could see into hers too, so she never opened them. But they were open now. Even after she closed the curtains, the feeling persisted that something wasn't right. She looked around the room, but there was nothing else out of the ordinary. Maybe it was just her, being home when she should be at work, being in Regina when she should have been somewhere else, done something else, become something else. Maybe it wasn't the curtains that were wrong, maybe it was her whole life. She stood in the arch between the kitchen and the living room and stared at the navy tea towels draped neatly over the oven door handle, at the bare fridge, at the dirty dishes and pots piling up in the sink, as though she had something better to do than wash dishes. The old her always had something better to do. The old her had stuff stuck all over the fridge door, ticket stubs from movies and concerts, four-frame photo booth pictures, tacky souvenir magnets from a friend who traveled a lot. When had she become this version of herself, the one with no hobbies or social life? She walked over to the counter and picked up a faded pink pottery mug, still half full of cold coffee from a day or so ago. Even coffee used to be a social thing. But now she just had a caffeine addiction. She drank it alone and out of necessity. Suna was officially lonely. She thought of Mackenzie's invitation. You can sit with me. But Maud would be there. The question was, did she not want to drink her coffee alone more than she did not want to drink her coffee with Maud? Paper Cup was not a place Suna ever would have stumbled across on her own. It was a narrow building stuck between a ratty-looking tattoo parlor and a sad gray crematorium. An ancient payphone stood beside the door, and a woman in an oversized denim jacket leaned against it, staring across the parking lot like it was an endless desert. She half smiled when she made eye contact with Suna, then turned and disappeared into the crematorium, at which point her bleak expression made perfect sense. Suna shuddered. She wouldn't mind being cremated next to a coffee shop, but she disliked the idea of drinking coffee next to a crematorium. A bell jingled over Suna's head as she entered the coffee shop, and suddenly she felt like she was back in Toronto, but 10 years earlier, where the bigger city's coffee shops had moved on to more modern, Instagram-worthy design trends and oat milk lattes. This place still had the chalkboard menu behind the counter, a plaque on the wall with a quote about not being able to function without coffee in that once trendy bridesmaid font. A soft folk song played in the background, and the baristas laughed together as they made drinks. What were the chances the mysterious letter writer was here already? First day, first hour. The skin on the back of her neck lifted at the thought of hearing the door open behind her, a familiar voice calling out her name. Suna, you came. Suna jumped and spun, fully expecting to see Brett standing there. And when she saw that it was only Mackenzie, trailed closely by Maud, she wasn't sure whether she was relieved or disappointed. Adrenaline traveled up her arms, and she tried subtly to shake it out. Mackenzie couldn't read Suna's expression either. You don't look happy to see us, she joked.
She carried an overly full backpack that made it appear as though she intended on camping at Paper Cup until the mystery person showed up. Maud stood close behind her, looking bewildered, like she'd never been out in public before. She was still wearing that ridiculous hat, and it looked even more bombastic in this granola coffee shop setting. Suna felt a twinge of empathy.
Hey! How are you guys?
Maud scowled.
It's too busy in here, too loud. Why would anyone come here to talk?
Because the crematorium doesn't serve coffee? Suna said. Maud stared at her blankly.
What crematorium? What are you talking about?
Mackenzie laughed.
I'm going to go dump this stuff at a table before there are none left. Would you order me a large black medium roast? Here, this is exact change.
She pressed some coins into Suna's hand, separated into two little groups.
That pile's for the tip.
Well, come here often?
I'm a university student. I live in coffee shops.
She started toward an empty table, then spun around, her backpack swinging into a man seated at the table behind her. Suna cringed.
Oh, Maud, what do you want? My treat.
I want to go home, Maud grumbled.
No, you don't. Come with me. Suna, grab Maud a tea or something. I'll pay you back.
Maud snorted.
I don't drink tea. Get me coffee. Nothing in it. Just plain black, fully caffeinated coffee.
She said it like she thought Suna might try to sneak something into her drink. When Suna arrived at the table, Maud was staring into space, and Mackenzie was awkwardly smiling at her hands in her lap. She looked relieved to see Suna.
Thanks for picking those up, she said. This is for Maud's.
She handed over another pile of change. Maud nodded, and the dark bouquet in her hat bobbled. Suna had a hunch this was as close as the woman ever got to saying thank you.
No worries, she said, carefully setting the cups down.
The three sat in silence for a minute. Suna scratched her arm. Why was she still here? Why had she come? Loneliness no longer seemed like a good enough reason.
So, you came, said Mackenzie again.
Yeah, said Suna, realizing she was actually excited to share the morning's events with someone. Oh, you'll never guess what happened downtown.
The bomb threat, said Maud.
Yeah, said Suna.
She slouched back into her chair.
How did you know about it?
We heard about it on the radio. Biggest thing to happen to this town in eons. It was at the art gallery downtown. Did you know that?
Maud had the same thirsty look on her face as Brenda. Like this was the only interesting thing that had ever happened in close proximity to her, and she wanted to be part of it somehow.
I can't believe this city even has an art gallery, Suna mumbled.
Of course we have an art gallery, said Maud indignantly. A very nice one. And now we've also had a heist. Our first art heist.
It wasn't a heist, said Suna, trying to quell her irritation. It was a bomb threat.
Means something, said Mackenzie. What does? Maud asked.
This morning when I woke up, I just had this feeling that something big was going to happen today, and then that happened. And I thought it wasn't the thing at first, because usually when I have that feeling, it's for something that affects me directly. But now Suna's here, and she was there when it all happened, so, you know, it's adjacent to me anyway. So it's not just a thing that happened, it means something.
Maud stared at Mackenzie like she'd turned blue.
What on earth are you talking about? What does it mean?
I don't know, said Mackenzie. You don't always know what it means when something means something. You just know that it means something, that it has meaning.
Maud widened her eyes much more than necessary, or even, one would think, possible, at Mackenzie. She made an over-exaggerated, incredulous face at Suna.
Oh, she said, sipping her coffee. You're one of those people.
Mackenzie appeared unbothered. She sipped at her coffee.
Sure, Maud. Not sure what you mean by that, but okay. I'm intuitive. I pay attention.
Maud grunted.
How was work last night?
Suna smiled politely, addressing Mackenzie and changing the subject.
Good.
Cool.
They all stared at each other, and Suna wondered if everyone at the table was trying to come up with an excuse to leave. But suddenly, Maud was noisily scooching her chair forward, her eyes fixed on Mackenzie.
So?
She said, when she finally appeared happy with the distance between the table and herself. She leaned in.
Who are you waiting for?
Mackenzie looked surprised.
You mean, like, who specifically? Now?
Of course. Who do you think wrote that letter? Who do you think is going to come here today?
Mackenzie looked around the crowded shop, her eyes resting on the mother and daughter at the next table. She watched them so intently and for such a long time that Suna wondered if she'd heard the question.
You said yesterday that you were thinking of an important person,
Maud persisted. Mackenzie nodded slowly, her eyes wandering back to the table.
I did, didn't I? You did.
Maud's eyes gleamed, and Suna could tell she was hoping for something really juicy.
Okay, sure, I'll bite. His name's Jared.
An old boyfriend?
Yep. He graduated about a month after we started dating. We were together that summer and all of the next year while he lived in another town, working for his uncle. I was in grade 11.
A year is a long time for a relationship at that age, said Suna. As soon as the words left her mouth, she worried they sounded patronizing, but Maud saved her by being downright condescending.
It was high school, she muttered. Those don't count.
Mackenzie looked truly offended for the first time since Suna had met her.
What do you mean they don't count? Of course they count. You can't go around telling people their feelings don't count.
Maud looked kind of sorry, but didn't retract her statement.
Well, she waved a hand, dismissing Mackenzie. They didn't in my day. I went out with a lot of boys back then, and I don't carry a torch for any of them.
She held her cup to her face and guzzled loudly. Suna turned to her. You're also not 19 or 20? She glanced at Mackenzie, who nodded.
19.
Yeah. She angled her body away from Maud. How long ago did you break up?
That's just it, said Mackenzie. We didn't break up. He ghosted.
Pardon? Maud said.
What do you mean he ghosted?
Oh, like he disappeared. From my life, I mean.
We didn't have a talk about breaking up. He just stopped calling, stopped coming home on the weekends to see me, stopped answering my texts. It was like we'd never met, like he'd never existed. I guess he just decided it was over.